The Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute is hosting two intensive 9-day seminars for college students this July in Seattle. For details, visit discovery.org/sem. That's www.discovery.org/SEM. The first track is a seminar on intelligent design in the natural sciences, which prepares students to make research contributions advancing the growing science of intelligent design. The second track, the C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society, explores the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts. Applicants for each program must be currently enrolled in a college or university as a junior, senior, or graduate student. Students selected will be provided with course materials, lodging, and most meals. Travel scholarships are available and will be awarded based upon need after acceptance into the program. For application information and other seminar details, please visit discovery.org/SEM. That's www.discovery.org/SEM.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Are humans the enemy? Should pigs and peas have constitutional rights? Today on ID the Future, Joshua Youngkin concludes his discussion on the new book and documentary film, The War on Humans, with the book's author, Discovery Institute Senior Fellow and bioethicist, Wesley J. Smith. Smith leads Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. In the fourth and final segment of the series, Smith discusses why we need to take the anti-humanism movement seriously. Be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com to get more information about the digital book and the documentary.
The book, of course, deals with more than we've talked about, but is there anything in it that you thought we should discuss so people can get an understanding of what exactly they're encountering and why these matter? Why these
things matter? You know, the war on humans, I don't get into any specific prescriptions for ecological or environmental practices. I don't really criticize any specific environmental practices except the idea of giving rights to nature. Like in New Zealand, they've declared a river in New Zealand to be a person with the rights of a person. And I point out, well, we were able to protect Yellowstone very well without making Old Faithful Geyser into a person. But the book, it's relatively short, about 100 pages. It shows the depth to which this anti-humanism has inculcated itself into the heart and soul of environmental advocacy. And it's a warning, not because I am not an environmentalist, but because I am one. I don't want to see the movement that has brought such beauty and protection of our lands to be subverted by an anti-humanism that will actually sacrifice ourselves to the supposed virtue of saving the planet. That's the wrong way to go. I think when people read the book, they will see that the things that I'm saying, which sound very radical, and they are not off somewhere in the distance fringe, somebody sitting in a corner with a pyramid made out of aluminum foil on his head. It's coming from some of the most mainstream, articulated spokespeople in environmentalism. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, believes in the rights of nature. Cass Sunstein believes that animals should be able to sue their owners or others. So I think what I'm trying to show in The War on Humans is that this anti-human ethic and advocacy is not something to be laughed at, but something to be engaged and rejected. That's what I'm trying to accomplish with The War on Humans. Don't take the advocacy seriously in the sense that it's right, but take the advocacy seriously in the sense that there are a lot of very powerful people who think it's right and will implement policies based on those pernicious views, those unwise views at the very best, unless people say, wait a second, nature shouldn't have rights, plants don't have intrinsic dignity, human beings have the highest value. Unless we say our policy should be based on that, then I think we're in real trouble. And so I guess I'm trying to say, hey, this is real. And while it has not yet become the law of the land, it is beginning to become the law of the land. And unless people wake up and say, nope, we're not going to go in that direction, the people who are committed to it will continue to move in that direction because they believe in it. But I don't think they represent the majority of people. I just think the majority of people don't take it seriously, and I'm trying to say you better.
Yeah. We talked a little earlier, and we'll close on this if that's okay, about energy.
Yeah.
About that being the driving factor in what gets passed as law, what becomes culture too in this social struggle.
We're talking about we're not talking about energy like in oil.
Not fossil fuels or wind or solar. We're talking about political will, really.
That's right.
The other side, the folks who really deeply believe in environmentalism as a proxy religion and as misanthropy, as you say, this is their core of their being.
Really. That's right.
Because for the majority of us, we have soccer games,
right.
football games,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
We have other things to attend to. So where does the energy
You have come? To believe that these radical environmentalists believe in their movement as much as a devout Catholic believes in the Mass and in the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. So that is what they live for. My view on history, I'm a history major, is not that the side that's right prevails. It's the side that's most committed prevails. In the Civil War, who had the most energy? Well, Robert E. Lee did, and that lasted a long time to keep the South, which really had no business being in the game, from losing for a long time. And only one person had more energy than Robert E. Lee, and that was Abraham Lincoln, until he found the right generals to be able to prevail. In World War II, Hitler had the most energy for a long time until he ran into Winston Churchill, who was able, through his indomitability, to save England and wait for us to come along and so forth. Now, I'm not saying that what we're facing now is the same thing as those horrendous wars, but I am saying that the group or the people with the most commitment and dedication will generally prevail. You see it in sports, too.
Yeah.
The team with the most commitment and dedication to winning that game will tend to win because of that commitment and dedication. And what I'm worried about is that a minority view could actually prevail because of the energy to which its adherents are pursuing their goals. Whereas the majority view tends to be complacent and laugh it off and think, well, it's self-evident that human beings have unique rights and no one's going to actually ever really believe this would occur. And there have been a lot of nations that have fallen and a lot of worldviews that have collapsed, even though they were held by the majority, because those attacking them had more energy. That also works in a positive way. I think in the civil rights era, you had more people initially committed to the status quo of discrimination than you did to the positive change of equality. And eventually, because of the greater energy on the part of the people with equality, they were able to persuade enough people that we were able to enter a new era. So nothing is a given in this world in the sense of just because something has greater righteousness, it will prevail.
I loop this back one more time. Energy, we find, often comes from the young crowd. So.
Yeah, and that's right. And the youth of today, I mean, I've got gray hair.
Yeah.
People can go on Google and take a look at my photograph. I don't dye my hair and you'll see that. But the youth of today are as committed to some of these anti-human agendas for idealistic reasons as people in my age were committed to overcoming Jim Crow and to fighting the Vietnam War. I also think there's some 60s envy going on. Where a lot of people want that kind of turmoil that characterized the 60s as if that was really a great time. It was a terrible time. Awful things happened in the 60s. But there's, I think, a romanticized view of that era. And I think there are people who keep trying to recreate that time of protest and change. Even though I think much of what we accomplished in the 60s was good, I think it also led us on a path that has turned unfortunate.
Well, thank you, Wesley, so much for being here. It's been a pleasure. One more time, this is Josh Youngkin and Wesley Smith for ID the Future. If you wouldn't mind taking a look at his book, War on Humans, we'll be glad to have you as a reader of that book. And also look out for the documentary. Thank you, Wesley.
Thanks, Josh.
Take care.
This concludes our interview series with Wesley J. Smith, author of the new digital book, The War on Humans, and contributor to the new documentary film of the same name. For more about the book and film, be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com. That's www.waronhumans.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.